something wrong with the podcast that you maybe can't tell me right now. You could blink a few times.
Hey, it's an audio medium, dipshit.
Today we're talking about Panic Room, starring Jodie Foster, Kristen Stewart, Forest Whitaker, Dwight Yoakam, Jared Leto, Patrick Bacow, I think, Ian Buchanan, and also, kinda, Nicole Kidman. Directed by David Fincher. I'm Ryan, one of your hosts here.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Matthew. Who's Nicole Kidman?
She was the mistress on the phone.
Ah,
yep. I'm Logan.
Yeah, and we are back here for our second to last week of our David Fincher series. For right now, we're going to be taking a little break. But for this week, we got Panic Room, his 2002 film. And the next week, we got a big one, Zodiac.
The biggest.
From 2007.
Twisted Mug Mysteries crossover there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Interesting.
Well, I mean, just because it's a mystery.
Okay. I was like, I didn't think that we did a Zodiac Killer episode.
No, we should.
But we should. And I'm sure we'll talk about it in great detail next week on the podcast. So come back next week for that review. But stay right now for this review. So guys, what we like to do here is give a little background on our experience with the films before we go into it. So had you guys seen Panic Room before this viewing?
Nope.
I had not.
I also had not. I had heard of it, wanted to see it, but had not seen it.
Yeah, same for me.
Yeah, this is now my second to last Fincher film that I haven't seen. The only one left that I haven't seen is Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which I hear is like 3 hours long, so probably the reason why I haven't watched it yet. Not that I have anything against long movies, it's just a big time commitment. This was after The Game, which was the other Fincher movie that I didn't see. I was like a little hesitant about watching Panic Room because I'm like, okay, I don't know what I'm getting myself into. Is there going to be some dumbass twist at the end that maybe undermines the entire movie? Who knows? That's all up to interpretation. But so I was excited to watch it, but I was, you know, a little just on edge just to make sure that it wasn't another The Game. Which again, go back and listen to that review. Some positives, but yeah, I think that. I don't know. Is there anything that happened in between? I don't think there's anything big that happened in David Fincher's career between Fight Club and Panic Room, but...
Wouldn't know.
I don't think so. I mean, I guess Fight Club was very popular, so...
Yes.
You know?
So he could probably do whatever he wanted at this point.
True. Yeah.
It wasn't popular when it came out. It only got popular when it came to, like, DVD and stuff, is when it started
really?
Becoming,
I
like,
did not know that.
Cult okay. classic.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I did some research on that when I was looking at the book and stuff last episode. Yeah.
It is now a classic. So we hit a classic with Fincher with Seven, and then a lesser known one with The Game, and then a classic with Fight Club, and now another lesser known. So I think it's interesting how his career is kind of going up and down like that in terms of how much his films are remembered. And I would say Alien 3 is pretty well remembered. I mean, it's a big part of a franchise, no matter if you liked it or not.
Yeah, that's definitely in the classics. Yeah, category. Yeah, I agree.
I would think so. I wouldn't agree in quality, but yes, in terms of people remembering it, I feel like that's probably one of his most well-known movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, we've had the debate so many times over about whether or not Alien 3 is a good movie.
It's up to interpretation.
I think it's safe to get into the mini plot summary here via IMDb of Panic Room.
Is it safe?
And start talking about this movie.
In the gritty.
Recently divorced Meg Altman and her daughter Sarah have bought a new home in New York. On their tour around their mansion, they came across the Panic Room, a room so secure that no one can get in. When three burglars break in, Meg makes a move to the Panic Room, but all her troubles don't stop. The criminals know where she is, and what they require the most in the house is in that very room. And that is the mini little plot summary of David Fincher's Panic Room. So guys, what was your first impressions on Panic Room?
This is I want to start with some positives. The acting in this movie is excellent, and the cinematography is really well done. I think this is a really well shot movie, and I think just like the performances, just in like might save what the rest of the film. The story of this movie is bad, and the script is bad. The plot holes are massive, and it's just, it's not well executed. they're in, like, and of course this is all my opinion. Maybe I missed something. Maybe it's something that's just not clicking in my head right now. I am completely open to changing my tune by the end of this podcast. But I got viscerally angry during my viewing of this podcast. My dad came downstairs and was like, "Why are you yelling?" And I was like, "Because this is a stupid movie." I was not happy with a lot of the things that they chose to do, because because the performances of all pretty much every single one of these performers was really great, and like there was just a lot of really cool things about this movie, but the story was just so poorly executed. And there's a line later on, literally, where I think it's Raoul or whatever is like, "Why didn't we do that?" Yeah. And I was like, "Yeah, why didn't you do that?" And it was just really, it felt really like rushed, and like they kind of slapped it together. And it felt to me in the end about just how, like, it felt like they realized they had so many plot holes, and then they were like, yeah. And then they realized that they made mistakes, and that's it, the end. So I don't know. We'll talk about it, but I have a few issues with this film.
I really dug this movie. I thought it was super fun, super gripping, super tense. It was the type of movie that I wish I could have seen in a theater. I thought it was very exciting. You know, maybe there are plot holes that I didn't pick up on. Usually, you know, they're not things that I'm looking for too closely, but maybe there are some that will come up in this discussion. But for me, I thought this was like pretty airtight. You know, there are some movies that you're sitting there and it's like, why did the character not do this? And then, you know, they do like a total opposite thing. But it seemed like in most scenes in this movie, I was like, you know, my brain would go to the next step and like, you know, what logically like this character should do. And then like they would do it. And I was like, oh, wow, like this like movie is like following along so well. I thought it was like really exciting. I love Jodie Foster. Like Silence of the Lambs, I found myself like rooting for her wholeheartedly. At the end, when she's on the phone with who I just recently found out is Nicole Kidman, she's like, "Give him the phone, bitch!" Like that was awesome. I was so into this movie. I found that I didn't think they really quite nailed the ending. I thought the ending was a little bit cheesy. And you know, it's a little bit of a goofy movie, I'd say. I think, you know, at times,
but not Fincher, the goofy movie.
Yes, I think at times Fincher overuses the micro zoom in CGI stuff, but I thought it kind of added to the goofy mood, and it was kind of fun. I mean, we've got Jared Leto with ridiculous cornrows who's popping pills. Like, it's just, it's a fun movie for me.
Yeah, I also really enjoyed this movie. Maybe there are plot holes, but you know, in the moment, I didn't really notice it. I think the camera work just instantly drew me in. This is the first time I think watching a movie that I've ever been like just completely struck by the camera work and like, oh wow, this is really well done. Like when people talk about how great camera work is, like this is the kind of stuff that they mean. Yeah. I really liked pretty much every performance, as all of the performances. I don't really have a flaw with it there. Yeah. Maybe there are plot holes, but I think while I was watching it, it was fascinating. I thought it was like watching just a really interesting game of chess. Like the, you know, Jodie Foster would do something, the robbers do something, you know, to react. And they're always sort of, I think the IMDb description says that it's like a cat and mouse game. Like it pretty much is. It's just, you know, they're always doing something. So I found that to be really interesting. And yeah, so, you know, maybe I'll find plot holes, but I'm excited to get into it. Cause I think, I mean, this just sucked me in and kept my attention the whole time.
Yeah. I liked this movie a lot. I thought it was fun. There is one big plot hole that doesn't really even add too much to the story that I'll get to. But yeah, like you guys said, all the performances are really good. I was a little nervous with Kristen Stewart. You know, child actors are always, you know, up in the air, even though Kristen Stewart's a really good actress now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a little nervous having like a, you know, 12-year-old being one of the main characters, but I thought she was very good.
And this is pre-Twilight.
This is way pre-Twilight, yeah. Jodie Foster was really good as the lead. I thought Forrest Whitaker was honestly the standout for me. I thought he was fantastic. Jared Leto was pretty good as well. I like this movie all around. It wasn't anything like special for me, I don't think. Like it wasn't, you know, even Fight Club, which I, you know, didn't like as much, still liked it, as I had on previous terms. You know, that's like a significant movie. This doesn't feel like a significant movie, but it's just a good, enjoyable, entertaining thriller,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I think, all the script was trying to be. I don't think it was trying to be anything, you know, out there. I think it was just trying to be a good piece of Hollywood entertainment, and I think that's what it was, and that's what it seems like. You know, maybe we'll start here with Fincher and his career. It seems like Fincher does one for the studio, which he did with Alien 3, and then did one for himself with 7, which really felt like, you know, him doing what he wanted to do. And then he did The Game, which was, again, a Hollywood action thriller, which I think works in some respects, doesn't work in other respects. And then he did Fight Club, which felt, again, very personal, like him trying to make a statement. And then again with Panic Room, he's doing another Hollywood blockbuster, but, you know, maybe not blockbuster is the right term for 2002, a thriller, but, you know, a Hollywood thriller. And I think that it's interesting to see Fincher early in his career getting to do one for himself, one for the studio. But it seems like, from what I remember, I mean, maybe Benjamin Button's this way because I haven't seen it, but it seems like from here he basically just does projects that he wants to do.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I agree. It seems like he kind of formed his vision or, you know, attained enough, you know, clout to be able to just make his own things, because from here on out, it's only up.
Yeah, I mean, this is still... This is only 10 years into his career at this point of making movies. And mm-hmm. I feel like at this point, even more than The Game 5 years earlier, he really just solidified himself as just being able to make a thriller. Just like, give me a generic thriller script and I will turn it into a really well-directed film. And I've said this about all of Fincher's movies. Like, no matter what I feel about the movie as the end result, I always feel like his direction is one of the biggest strengths of the film. Like Fight Club, I didn't love the way the story was fully handled. I didn't love the way the story was handled in The Game, but I always felt like his direction was strong, and I definitely feel that way here.
Yeah, definitely.
I agree with you that I think that Fincher does a really great job taking scripts that are kind of generic and maybe not the best thought out and turning them into really good movies. I was surprised to look up, though, that I was surprised to learn that David Koepp is the writer of this script, who wrote Jurassic Park and Mission Impossible and Spider-Man. Like, he has done
very
some
prolific worker.
Yeah, he's done some really good work. So I was just like really surprised that, like, you know, this script is as bad as it is.
I disagree with you. I don't think it's a bad script. I think it has just maybe some small plot holes. I mean, he has done films like Inferno and The Mummy as well.
That's fair.
And You Should Have Left, that just came out. But I mean, he has pretty good movies. Like, I've heard Premium Rush is very good. I haven't seen that. He also wrote Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit, which is a solid action movie.
Oh, he did Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. So
he did do Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which I don't think I can really comment on because I haven't seen that since theaters. I know it's not well received now, but yeah, I mean, he wrote Jurassic Park. He wrote Mission Impossible. Even The Lost World, I think, is an underrated Jurassic Park movie. Yeah, he wrote Spider-Man. Yeah, I mean, he's a very prolific writer, and I think that, you know, not all of them are going to be winners, but I wouldn't say this is a bad script in any way. I think that it's maybe a generic script.
In any way?
I don't think it's a bad script. No, I don't think it's a bad script.
Yeah, I think it's tight. I think it's cool. Yeah, I mean, I like you said, Floyd, I think David Koepp and David Fincher came into this knowing what they wanted to do, and I think the writer was like, I want to make a thriller, a cat and mouse thriller, and he did it. You know, it's a very well-executed thriller, one of those, we're in a house, we're not going to leave the house, we got these confines, and the movie is going to exist within these confines, and I think the rules of the movie work out well.
I think some of the things that they do... sorry, Logan, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but just to kind of put it out there, since I am like the only one on the opposite side, I think it's just some of their actions don't really click for me, but we'll get into that later.
Well, let's get into talking about it chronologically, and then we can get into all your specific complaints there. All
right. So we have to start at the beginning, as we always do.
Title sequence.
Title sequence is fantastic.
Awesome.
Very
cool.
It's very goofy, great, and fun. It's perfect. I think it fits
it
the
feels
movie.
So 2002, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It very much does.
Yeah.
I love, like, the letters in the sky. Like, when they're showing one name, you can see Jodie Foster's name in the background.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not just showing you these when it needs to show you these. Like, the movie, this is basically the movie saying, like, no, these just exist in New York City. These letters are just floating.
Jodie Foster is just floating, and
she's just floating in New York City. And then I love when we see Panic Room, and you can see the reflection in the building. It's I just it was very well done. I mean, yeah, I love it.
It feels like in the early 2000s, they got the CGI ability to do this kind of stuff, and they're like, we're going to do it so hard. We're just going to nail this.
Yeah,
it feels like a superhero opening, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. And it doesn't really look bad now, like a lot of CGI.
No, it doesn't.
Like, you know, they didn't really try to do that much with it, so I feel like it works.
I mean, you can tell it's CGI, but, like, of course it's CGI. Like, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't look bad at all. But no, yeah, I was even thinking beyond that as the start. For the three of us here, minus Brendan, this opening scene was a huge deal, because we had Dick Tremaine there showing around the house.
Yes, of Twin Peaks fame. That? Yeah, that was awesome. And it was and it was literally Dick Tremaine, you know? It was
so great. Oh, I loved it.
Instead of men's fashion, he's in real estate, which, it makes sense for him.
I have a ticket or a meeting that I have to get to.
Even the way he opens up the door, it's just like everything was perfect.
I loved this scene, not just because I could see Ian Buchanan do something else, but just, I thought he's just legitimately really good. I think he's really funny, and I love the way...
he's great in Twin Peaks, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's great, and I think, this intro, maybe it's a little bit of a kind of heavy exposition dump, but I think it makes sense. I think, you know, they have to give us basically a rundown of all of the little features in the house. I think it makes sense. It's just, maybe it's a little forced, but I think it's really perfect for establishing the setting, which is kind of the main focus.
Yeah, and again, what I'm saying about the script being a pretty good script, I think that, you know, what Cap's able to do in the screenplay here is that what's really hard about single location films is that you have to get to the location has to be a character in the story, and that's very hard to write in. And I can see where the points, I haven't looked at the script, but I'm sure it says, there's the elevator, there's the winding staircase, third floor, you know, there's the bedrooms and the den, and then the second floor, there's the panic room. I'm sure this was very very descriptive. And I think that what is good about having this, you know, walkthrough with Ian Buchanan's character is that you get to see the battlefield almost of what is to come. And I mean, everyone knows what this movie is going into it. It's called Panic Room. The poster has Forest Whitaker there and Jodie Foster in the Panic Room. Like, you know what this is going to be. You know this is going to be a thriller, a contained thriller. And I think what it does a really good job of setting things up too. But then the scene after that, after they move in, I think is very, does exposition really well, I think. Because at first you're like, oh, when they're having the conversation, you're like, oh, she used to be, you know, married to him. I assumed that he was dead, just by the way she said that. But then later, I like how when they're sitting there eating dinner, just natural dialogue saying, and this is what I say, I think Logan has picked up on something that I had said that I had learned here in film school, is that you only notice, like, it's only bad exposition if you are hearing people say words that they should already just be implied. Mm-hmm. And they did that in the movie because they gave that small thing of like, oh, I used to be married to him. And then with Kristen Stewart's character just sitting there and saying, fuck him and fuck her, you know, they're divorcing. He had, you know, had a mistress. And then it's very natural. And I feel like that's why I bought into the beginning of this film, is because I feel like it was very naturally written by David Koepp.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, you know, I think good directors can sometimes use exposition to their advantage. See Inception by Christopher Nolan. And also, Floyd...
Which is just exposition the movie.
Literally, but, yeah.
Yeah.
But somehow it works. And Floyd, you were talking about with like this house as a sort of chessboard, reminded me of, if anybody has seen this movie, Steven Spielberg's Minority Report.
No, I need to.
Yeah. You have? I don't know if you remember, yes. But the scene where Tom Cruise is kind of in that old decrepit apartment building, and the camera literally zooms out like all the way, and you see from the top down like each room as an individual unit, and you see cops coming this way and Tom Cruise coming this way, and it's literally like a chessboard, and it reminded me of this film and how this house is very much so a character. And I love how the camera just, we're going everywhere, all over the house, all three floors. It feels very established.
I thought very much of Die Hard and Home Alone.
Yeah.
In terms of the house being a character. And this is sort of halfway walking in between on the glass, those, I think, totally. Yeah, right, walking on the glass, but yeah.
Yeah, there was multiple times where I'm like, she's home alone in this shit right now.
Yeah. I think that for a lot of it, it's interesting. It actually kind of reminded me of like a video game, in that like you know the layout of like the place. Like you have a map. And even if you have to like hold down in this one place, it's like one of those things where like various things I'm trying to think of a good example, and of course my mind is completely blank. But it's like,
that's how it goes.
You have the, well, yeah, but you have this like set map and you're like, this is the area that we're going to be in for like the entirety of this experience. But like all new things are sort of going to happen while you're in this. And it's interesting to see how it like changes in terms of like the dialogue in the beginning. The reason that I was so quick to praise some of the performances is because I think that like, that is really like, it really lends it to communicating those thoughts. Even if you're not like getting specific exposition, which I think that like is one thing that in the beginning of this, you know, just like the dialogue alone does really well, like you were saying, but also the fact that like, Kristen Stewart does a really great job like playing this character. And I wasn't really sure if she would, but she like their dynamic, between her and Jodie Foster really like it's incredibly prevalent in just the first like few minutes of this movie. And I think that that is something that it does do very well.
Yeah, and even the, you know, the fact that Kristen Stewart has what is it, low blood sugar, and she has the, you know,
I think she has diabetes.
Diabetes. Yes,
exactly. You know, and that's never explicitly stated. You know, it's just kind of like we see Jodie Foster look down at the watch. We see, you know, the numbers going down, and you slowly in your head you're like, okay, like this is adding to the tension, just slowly racketing it up.
And it makes it makes more sense on retrospect why she was telling her to watch her sugar intake with the Coke at the beginning, exactly. Those kind of things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that that definitely gives it a little bit of a time clock that we have to be thinking about it the whole time, and it's like it just gives it this sense of pacing that, you know, there's gonna be this event that happens partway through the movie, and yeah, it's very stressful.
The fact that like you're in a tense situation, and compounded that is that you can't get too tense. You can't get too stressed out. Both Jodie Foster and Kristen Stewart. Because Jodie Foster's, if she gets too stressed out, then Kristen Stewart will get too stressed out. You know what I mean? And I think that's a really cool dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also just to have that extra thing beyond just, oh, you're trapped in this room. It's like, and it's not, and again, what I like about it doesn't feel like it's exploiting, you know, the condition. It doesn't feel like it's, you know, using it as like, something that is just supposed to be a plot point. Actually, I think because we're connected to Kristen Stewart's character already, I think we like her. She's a, you know, a fun young kid. She's always, you know, she's swearing already about, you know, her father's affair. She seems very well aware of everything that's going on. You know, I think that endears us to her. And then to have, you know, just this medical ailment on top of it, I think really adds to the suspense, where most of the time you're like, oh, this kid's not actually going to get hurt. I never thought that Kristen Stewart was actually going to die. But I did think that there was a possibility when she said coma. I think I thought it was a possibility that she would go into a coma during the movie. So, but you know, yeah. Moving on, it takes about 20 minutes to get there, but I think we've talked about the setup enough.
Mm-hmm.
Where we get more of what Fincher did in Fight Club with this digital cinematography, which now you can tell it's digital cinematography, but I'm sure at the time was a huge deal.
Sure.
Of going around the house while the three guys are trying to break in. And in terms of this scene of getting to know these three characters, I think this is a really effective scene. I like these three characters. Raul's my least favorite, for sure. He's the most boring. I mean,
he's
Junior
also a country
and Forest Whitaker's. Is he really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know why the fuck they were
weird.
Like, sure. Let's have Dwight Yoakam play Raul.
I mean,
yeah,
why would
I looked at his
Fight Club.
Yeah, maybe he just, I mean, that's maybe fair. Goes back to his work of music videos. I don't know. Yeah.
Also possible.
But no, yeah, I like the three of them. I don't dislike the performance of Raul. David Yoakam. I just think that the character of all the characters is the most bland,
dude.
Just cuz he's just the crazy dude with a gun. Like, I think Jared Leto's Junior and Forest Whitaker's Buchanan are just more interesting, complex characters. But I do like the three of their dynamic.
Yeah, and Raul, they kind of build him up, or at least for me, they kind of set him up in the beginning like there may be some sort of reveal with him, you know, when he takes
with
his
mask
off. I was like, is this
just
the husband? You know, I was a little bit confused there, but... you know, I never quite felt the payoff for that character. But yeah, Floyd, I mean, that... you know, once Jodie Foster goes to sleep, and once we get that no cut scene where we travel from the third floor all the way down to the first, oh, that was so immersive. I love that. I had heard of that scene beforehand, and kind of a list of, you know, best, no cutscenes. And, oh, man, that was great. I love how we go through the coffee handle. And, you know, we see Forrest Whitaker go up the ladder. And then by the time we get to the third floor, he's already on the roof. I love how we've got all these pieces going on. It was so much fun. I love that shot.
Yeah, I think the camera work here is hypnotic. Like, it just, this is the scene I was talking about. Mm-hmm. It just completely draws me in. And I know, Ryan, we've talked about some, like, shot length of different directors. And I sent you, you know, a chart that had different David Lynch movies, different, you know, shot lengths, average shot lengths. And I love this. I think, like, you notice exactly what he's doing before, you know, before he even starts doing with the scene. Like, obviously the real shot isn't going to, like, go through the coffee handle or go through a keyhole or, like, the floor at one point. But, like, this is still, like, a 2-minute shot, and it's so mesmerizing. I love it. I don't even, like, there are, like, a couple moments where you can notice that it's CGI, but, like, I don't think that it's that bad. I think it still largely pretty much holds up. And I think Fight Club was probably, like, the first time that he tried that, and I think it's better used here, in my opinion.
It's 3 years later in technology.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he nailed
it. I still noticed it. And you guys said it immersed you. It pulled me out kind of because I noticed it. I was like, oh, this is definitely, you know, early age digital cinematography. But I don't blame that on the movie, and I don't blame that on Fincher, the cinematographer, because I'm sure at the time it was like, wow, look at this incredible thing that we can do with this technology. I mean, today it just kind of looks like a really good PS4 game, but again, the fact that it even holds up that well almost 20 years later, I think, is a compliment to the film.
Even when they're not, you know, going through keyholes and everything, there are just some really cool tracking shots in the rest of the movie.
Yeah. Fincher's cinematography. And from here on out, I think we really get Fincher's look in all his movies. I mean, Zodiac, Gone Girl, all those films are so Fincher.
I feel like every movie has had it.
Yeah, but I feel like this. I feel like it starts with this one. Because his
really?
His,
Seven? Yes.
I think Seven is a bit of an outlier in terms of his cinematography.
Really?
Yeah, because it doesn't feel as smooth. The classic Fincher panning that he always does, the way that is so attuned to characters. I'll talk about it more once we get to Zodiac and further movies, but there was this video essay I once saw, and it was about how Fincher just, draws you into the character so well by every single motion, just following them. It's so beautiful.
Use Gone Girl as the main example, I think.
Yeah, Gone Girl and Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah. Which I'm very excited to get to those movies. I'm Lots excited to rewatch those movies. Yeah, he likes the word girl, I guess, in titles.
I guess.
I don't know. That was a weird thing that back-to-back movies just had that in the title. But how do you guys feel about these characters, the dynamic between them? Like I said already, I think Forrest Whitaker's a standout here, but I think Jared Leto is also very good in this movie, Jared Leto is 48. I looked this up because I was like, how old is Jared Leto? Because I feel like he's always in everything. And he's 48, but he still looks like he's in his 20s. Like, this man is taking care of himself.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you mean he's 48?
He's 48.
He's Jesus.
I love all the dynamics between the characters. I think it's really fascinating. I sort of saw it coming a little kind of early that Forrest Whitaker's character might sort of come around.
He's
kind
of a good guy.
Obviously. I think it was very obvious. Yeah, I don't hold that against the movie.
At all. And I think, I enjoyed all of the dynamics. You know, they're working for each other and working with each other and against each other. It's, it was pretty fascinating stuff.
I really liked, you know, the use of Forrest Whitaker kind of being this good guy, even if it was a little obvious at the beginning. Because I actually thought that, like, the dynamic between him and Jared Leto was really interesting in the beginning. But the second they started using Raoul more, I was just like, it really took me out of it. Because I was really, like you said, Ryan, I was just not a fan of his character. And, like, it wasn't even the fact that he was, like, doing all these shitty things, but he was like, oh, here's a gun. Oh, he killed someone. It's the crazy white guy with the balding hair. And, like, oh, he's insane. Ooh, he's gonna smash her face with a sledgehammer. And I was like, this is so fucking... It was, I don't know, I was just very tired of it very quickly. But all of the other characters, I think, were really solid performances, and I really enjoyed them. So that's what you get for bringing in a fucking country singer to a movie.
I definitely didn't dislike him as much as you did, but I feel the same way, but on a much lower scale as you.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think that you know, their dynamic is really good here. And again, natural through dialogue, I think, is really good here, because we get to know the situation very slowly through their dialogue. Again, I don't feel like there's any point in the dialogue where they say something that they wouldn't have already, you know, had said to each other, just through understandings. And I think that being able to write the dialogue to do that, to still fully communicate to the audience over a short period of time what is happening, but still feel natural, again, is something very hard to do, which is why I think that I respect this movie and I like this movie a little more than the game, is because the script feels more natural. And I like the suspense that they immediately build up with Jodie Foster getting up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night while they're there and arguing. I think that this movie, immediately after this cool sequence of them breaking in, immediately raises the stakes, and you know that shit's about to go down.
Yeah, and it's weird. Like, I don't know if you guys felt this way, but I wasn't necessarily ever scared by these three robbers.
No.
But I'm not even saying that as a negative. It was just, I don't know, it was a different approach. I feel like maybe a different movie would have made them a little bit, maybe would have made all of them Raouls, made them all very over the top. But I thought that more than anything, it was just very, very tense. And, you know, it never felt like a horror movie. It just felt very, very grounded. And this is a thriller. And, like, we have to get to this point at this time while these people are running after you. And that is, you know, all of what the sequence is, Floyd. You know, when she grabs her daughter and we finally get into the panic room.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And once we get in there and they start having these interactions with each other, I think... you know, Forest Whitaker, he's great at this point, but I think Leto is definitely the standout at this point in the movie. And, Leto, you know, he'd had an interesting career up to this point. We had mentioned American Psycho before, I think last week with Fight Club. Really good in that movie, much different role, obviously, as another fellow Wall Street guy. He was one of the other main Wall Street guys in American Psycho. And, you know,
Requiem for a Dream. By this point.
Oh yes, and he was big for Requiem for a Dream. So, you know, he's doing his thing. He's a very good actor. I think he's very commanding on the screen, and I like the dynamic that specifically him and Raoul, and like he is a good center point between Buchanan and Raoul.
Yeah.
And you know, some of the did I say something wrong?
Buchanan. No, oh, it starts with a B, but it's not Buchanan.
Oh, Burnham.
Is it not Buchanan?
Forrest Whitaker's character. Yeah, Burnham.
Oh, is it Burnham?
Yeah,
Burnham. I'm sorry.
Not Buchanan.
That's what I meant Burnham. Sorry.
Yeah. It's weird because there's someone else in the movie named Buchanan.
Yeah, the BU names. I'm sorry. I got them mixed up.
Yeah.
I like how he's the center point between their relationship. Like, he's trying to keep them both at bay. And I like the dynamic there. And, you know, once we get into the panic room, I'm a little more invested in the robbers and in Jodie Foster and Kristen Stewart, which I think is understandable because we're spending more time with them almost, trying to break in. But, you know, once Forrest Whitaker's character thinks of the gas, I think that's where the movie really takes off.
I think that part of my issue with Raoul is that, like, when you start to spend more time with the robbers, they're like, you do, like, I was more invested in their storyline, but, like, there was just this kind of, like, the ways that he acted were just, like, it threw off the whole dynamic for me. And I mean, like, and I think, like, it, having, like...
I think that's intentional.
Sure. And I think that, like, having the dude that, like, is taking it too far is one thing. But, like, the stuff that they did with him later and, like, where they were like, oh, he's crazy, he's gonna come at you. And it was like, and now he has a gun. And I was like, why is he, like, taking over? And, like, there was no... Like, they put the mask on him, but there was no reveal. And I think that was part of my problem with it, was that, like, I really liked Forrest Whitaker and Jared Leto, but there was just no follow through on the character of Raoul, except for just being that he was this crazy dude.
Yeah, I just didn't mind any of that. Like, I liked that he was this, like, crazy unhinged guy that, like, Jared Leto brings him in, and then, you know, it's like he just totally throws off the balance, and he is very, like, crazy. He is unhinged. I don't know, like, you're saying all these things, and I'm like, I don't really see that as a negative. I thought this character was very interesting.
Sure. And I think just a personal problem, but...
Sure, yeah.
If you don't see it that way, that's fine.
Yeah, I'm definitely in the middle point. I did have some problems with Raoul. I think The gun part was fine. I just think at some point he maybe just the character just felt a little over the top. Like, of course, he's just trying to be this menacing guy. But in terms of the three different levels of the robbers, I do think it works having him be the most aggressive, Leto being in the middle, and then Whitaker being the, you know, the most compassionate. And now that I'm thinking about it, doesn't it almost feel like Forrest Whitaker is the main character of this movie?
Kind of, yeah.
To some extent.
Yeah, I guess.
I can see it.
Which I don't think is a problem, actually, because I think that, you know, he seems like he has the most going on. He is probably the most sympathetic character in the movie, because, he's doing this, but it sounds like he's doing it partially for his kids, partially for himself. Maybe not sympathetic, but he's the most interesting. Like, Jodie Foster and Kristen Stewart are just, you know, living their life just in their new home, and then, you know, they have to go into a panic room and stay away from robbers. Meanwhile, you kind of have to think about, like, what drove, you know, seemingly a good person, and I think by the end, at least someone who wants to do the right thing most of the time, Forrest Whitaker's character, and following him and getting his journey throughout the movie, I think became the most interesting for me.
Yeah, I mean, you get the sense that he's definitely, like, a kind guy. He doesn't want to take it too far. And even just in terms of, like, intelligence, when you put it up against Leto and Raul, he built the panic room. He knows how to get to it. He's the guy coming up with all the ideas. And although they are the ideas to put Jodie Foster and Kristen Stewart in more danger, you know, the two, like, protagonists, I guess, I'm still, like, kind of on his side in a weird way. Because you know he's not going to, you know, hurt
them. He doesn't want to, he always says this is just to scare them or to get them to come out. This is not to hurt them. And then it's the other people who take it too far.
Yeah. I thought he was great.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I feel like with his redemption, I saw it like more like a Darth Vader kind of redemption. Like, cool that he did a good thing, but like, that doesn't mean that we're going to forget that like his character is still kind of a piece of shit. Like, he did a lot of really bad stuff. And I think he doesn't deserve, like, forgiveness. It's a little bit of a redemption arc. Like,
And I think the movie notes that. It's him getting caught.
I'm curious if you guys felt that, because I felt like they were setting that up in the beginning, that, like, he was always just like, I just want the money, and, like, I don't want anything to do with them. Because, he comes in and says, like, they weren't supposed to be here. Like, there wasn't supposed to be anyone else in this house. I'm curious to know what you guys think about this, but I wish that we had got more time with Leto's character, because I think that he has, like, I love the fact that he is just, like, this kind of shitty, like, little dude that no one in his family likes, and that, like, it's like, oh, you are getting less than everyone else because everyone hates you.
He's Eric Trump.
He's literally, like, the Eric Trump of this family. With cornrows, just a, like, a step behind.
Which, are we sure that Eric Trump didn't have cornrows at some point?
He probably did. Not. But I don't know. I'm interested to hear what you guys think, because I wish we would have spent, like, more time with his character instead of him just getting killed pretty early on.
I thought it was the adequate amount, because I thought that, like, I loved him a lot, but I think that if he would have been in the entire movie, I think his energy would have kind of gotten a little bit tiresome for me. I would have been like, all right, I get it, you're crazy. I probably would have taken the same approach you took to Raul. So I thought his demise was appropriate.
Yeah, he served his purpose for me.
I wish I would have gotten a little more time to sit with what he was talking about in terms of his family, so that it was, like, super clear with the audience, like, what he did and how he screwed these guys over.
So he's the grandson? Is that the deal, right? He said that at some point?
I think so, or a nephew, or something. And he, yeah.
Well, I think that's my point. Really, where it's like, I mean, the details of that don't really matter that much.
The,
like,
details don't matter, but I just kind of wanted to sit with the whole thing that he, like, set these guys up. Wait, maybe even just for another minute of screen time. Maybe. You know?
Yeah. For me, this falls into the category of, like, they don't need to explain a ton more. Like, it's pretty naturalistic dialogue, and I feel like keeping around for more of an amount of time to be like, yeah, he was my grandfather or something, like, or I'm his nephew, like. Just giving
whatever that is, yeah.
Giving the right, whatever he was, like, giving the extra detail. I just didn't really need it. It was, yeah.
So you were more invested in the Jodie Foster and Kristen Stewart storyline.
I was interested in all of it, but, like, I don't, like, when they're not, you know, like, we've been talking about how they're not at no point in this movie is anyone saying anything that they wouldn't have already said to each other. And that's the, you know, that's, I think what I think makes the dialogue really good. And so, I was interested in all of it, but I don't know. I don't need any more explanation from him.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
I do think that his death is a very shocking moment. I didn't see it coming.
Yeah, me neither.
When he was walking out, I thought he was just going to leave. And it does raise the stakes in a very good way. And I like it. I like it a lot. I think his death scene is very effective. But also beyond that, you know, just to talk about a couple of the small different sequences that go on through this movie, I think the gas sequence is very thrilling. Mm-hmm. Very well done. I like that a lot. I like the Morse code very thing. Cool visual. Yeah, I thought it was so fun when she said, "Where'd you learn this?" And she says, "Titanic." That's fun. that was a fun reference because I mean, at this point, that movie would have been 5 years old, and already the biggest movie of all time at the time. But yeah, no, it's just I like these little sequences. You know, I know nothing very bad is going to happen to the characters, but I do like these little set pieces that they have throughout the movie. Which of these were your favorite, guys?
I did love the gas leak. Yeah. You know, both the tension as you know, turn it up, turn it down. You know, between Forrest Whitaker and the guys, and then once Jodie Foster gets the idea to you know to light it with the fire blanket over her. I mean, that was
awesome. Thought Leto's head was gonna explode at that point.
I know. Oh, that was so good. And I love the realization from Whitaker. Like no, something is gonna happen. Like back up. Oh, that was great.
Yeah, no, that's a great sequence. I do also like the cell phone sequence
just pulls.
I think everything with the phones is very good. Again, this movie is very 2002 in terms of the technology. Also, like, this is not how it would work today. You can't remake this movie in the same way in a modern setting, because even at one point when Forrest Whitaker, a very small moment, but I think the audience at the time would have just understood it, was that when they get into the panic room and they're in the room, he just goes up to the monitor with all the screens and just checks to see if there's tapes in any of the recorders. And when he sees they're not, he's like, all right, we're good. They don't know, like, the cops won't be able to see that we were here.
Yeah, that was, I figured out what was going on there, but barely, you know.
You get some of the stuff with the phones. I was like, wires?
Right.
Connected wires? To phones?
What is a landline?
I was just like, yeah, I trust that this made sense back then. This was how phones worked. I mean, we were all like toddlers at this point.
Yeah, exactly. It's like to the point where she was like, it felt like a weird piece of dialogue. She's like, I set up the phone line, and Kirsten Stewart's like, yeah, cool. And then for the point of the movie to be like, she set up a phone line, but she didn't set up the right phone line.
Yeah.
It's like, this is just so like beyond the technology that I'm used to.
But I do love how they set up that tiny, tiny detail, and it seems like just the most boring thing, but then they actually do bring it back. I mean, they're setting up, you know, even for me watching it today, it set up the fact that when you move into a new house, you need to set up a phone line. Like that was a mechanic of this world. And it's not like some weird like sci-fi alternate universe that they need to set up all these mechanics, but like it's just 2002, but they did a good job setting that up. And you know, she needed to connect the phone line, and then she didn't do it for the one in the panic room. And I think that was really smart. The way that came back later it was pretty, pretty airtight.
Yeah, someone that just moved into a new house/apartment. I understand the anxiety of it, but no, I didn't have to worry about setting up my phone line as soon as I moved in. I had to worry about other things, but yeah, no, it was relatable. I mean, not the phone line, but it was relatable, definitely. The stresses of moving into a new space and taking on responsibility.
I, too, can relate to Forrest Whitaker chasing me down my hallway.
Yeah, it's just, it's scary.
I hate it when that happens.
When Forrest Whitaker like, save the rebellion.
When a country music star decides to come into your house with a gun.
With a silencer.
Yeah.
Burns Forrest Whitaker's face. You know, you just, I know what this is like. To my biggest plot hole that I want to talk about, unless there's something before this, stop me if there's something before this in the movie that you guys want to talk about. When they go into the panic room, when they get Jodie Foster out and Raoul and Forrest Whitaker, because I keep forgetting his character's name, Burnham. Into the panic room. And again, this is such a stupid plot hole because it doesn't actually change the plot that much. The door closes on Raoul's hand, even though Ian Buchanan made it perfectly clear that should not be possible.
Yeah, but they made it very clear that he could open it, or he could stop it from opening because there was like a laser, and he was putting the green laser, and he was putting his hand, when Ian Buchanan did it, he was putting his hand right like on the laser, and that's what stopped it from closing. We saw that Raul's hand was like lower than that, and so then it closed and hit him. That was
I agree. Because so my mind went to the plot hole, but then I remembered it. Yeah,
it wasn't really explained like with dialogue, but it was just shown to us that what happened with Raul was different from what happened with the real estate guy.
So it doesn't make sense then. I mean, I'll grant you that that's probably the explanation, but it doesn't make sense then with the safety of the panic room door is you have to hit these exact 2 points or else the door's going to fucking slam and crack your hand. Like,
yeah, it's like a poor design thing for sure. But it works in the movie, I guess.
I guess it does work in the movie, but like I was like just sitting here thinking about it, like, okay, so you have to hit this exact pinpoint laser, you know, hit something with this exact pinpoint laser or else you're fucked because right. I mean, the door's just going to slam on your hand.
Yeah. If it's like your whole body going through, then it wouldn't be an issue. But like, I guess for that guy, he just put his hand in an unlucky spot. But yeah.
Yeah. And how many times do you close a car door on your whole body? No, you close the car door on your hand.
Just halfway through the door.
And you close it. You don't just like slam yourself halfway through the door. No, you catch your fingertips in a door. Sure. You know?
I caught my
torso in the door.
Yeah, exactly.
This scene, I think, occurs right before they go into the panic room, and I was confused by this. It's the moment where Raul switches into. Oh wait, is this later when he switches into the father's clothing? Am I jumping ahead?
Mm.
Like that? Like we don't see it happening, and
I forget the exact order of it.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit ahead. I think
you might be right that it's before. I think it is right before. Yeah, yeah. I think that's how they get in.
That's what a good point to bring up. Yeah, because when he gets in, he's in the trench coat. Right. So Jodie Foster gets out somehow, and we don't see it happening, but we hear the scuffle. Right. Because Forrest Whitaker's mad. Because that's right. Because the Dwight Yoakam character is beating up the father, and he's like, "No, stop!" And we just kind of see their shadows, and we don't really know what's going on. And then when they emerge, we see like one man with the trench coat on, and then we see Forrest Whitaker, and then it's
dragging,
did they switch clothing? That the thing?
Yeah.
Wait, but so why was that? Just to throw off her?
Yeah. To throw her off. Did they get her to come out of the space?
Okay, yeah. No, it makes sense. I was just confused because the way they shot it, it made it seem like it was some sort of reveal that Raul and Forrest Whitaker had been in cahoots the whole time.
I think it was a reveal that they changed clothes.
Yeah. No, I know now. But it was just like, okay, we didn't see what was happening in the room. And then like, the audience is deceived for a bit because we think the person getting thrown down the stairs is Raul.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just weird because Raul and Forrest Whitaker were actually mad at each other. But then like they just started working together and switch the clothes quick?
They put aside.
That's why I was confused.
Yeah, they were like, "Hey, this should work," and then it did.
But he was so mad at
it. Worked
him
for me. It because
all
me.
The yelling was like, "No, Raul, stop! Stop kicking him! Stop! Stop! Stop!" And that was what we heard. And then it just like switched, and I was like, "Oh, are they cool now?"
Yeah, well, I think they just staged that to trick Jodie Foster.
Yeah. Okay. That's I was just. It's not a big thing. I was just a little bit confused by it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It worked for me. I thought I didn't have any problem with that. I thought it was actually a really great sequence.
Yeah, I wasn't that confused by it, all things considered.
When it slowed down like that.
I guess. I'm just dumb. Let's continue.
I guess, Matt. That's just that's always the explanation.
Matt's just
dumb. No, of course I'm kidding. But no, yeah. So
I guess we just
do
don't understand how landline phones in 2002 worked.
I know. Yeah, I guess. That is the explanation to everything that we don't understand in movies from now on. Right, we just don't know how landlines work in 2002.
Fuck.
I do like when then Jodie Foster is out and about. She's breaking the mirrors, kind of setting up the house Home Alone style. I think it's
so bad.
It's really effective. She starts knocking out the camera. She gets the gun.
Why didn't
that part probably makes the least sense.
Probably. But. Yeah, I mean, but also these guys don't really seem like they're trained criminals. Like,
right.
Jared
like
Leto
they had a plan,
is
though, kind of.
They had a plan, but like Jared Leto is like,
well, not
well,
really.
They
didn't think
they were going to be there.
They didn't think they were going to have to worry about the cameras when they came in because they didn't think that anyone was going to be there. So why would they?
It's interesting that they did know about them, like to the extent that they were like, okay, they are in every room, but then they just didn't, you know, do anything about them.
Well, they didn't need to because they didn't. I mean, they wouldn't have had a plan for that because they didn't think that anyone was going to be there again.
Like, but once they knew that people were in the house, is what I'm saying. Why?
Yeah, it's a small plot hole.
Yeah,
I would say like Eric Trump, played by Jared Leto, was like, "Hey, I want to steal Granddad's fortune," and then he was like, "Hey, you used to work on, you know, you installed this safe, so I'm going to get you, and I know that you're in some legal trouble, so I'm going to get tempt you with some money," and then Raul just has a gun, so we're going to bring him. Even though I think Jared Leto didn't want him to bring a gun. I don't know how Raoul weaseled his way into this plan, but...
Exactly.
I think for me, it all works enough because they're not seasoned criminals. This is just a rich kid trying to get some extra money.
It makes sense because Raoul is dumb because we literally get the scene. It's a funny scene where he's banging on the ceiling and, you know, Burnham is like, dude, there's steel. Like, you can't break through it. And then he kind of pauses. And then just keeps going. And
yeah,
keeps
he's like, we'll see. And then he keeps going. Yeah.
And it also makes sense, you know, one, because Leto and Raoul wouldn't think to break the cameras. And I don't think Forrest Whitaker would have wanted to break the cameras because he was using those to communicate to Jodie Foster. But, like, at the one time, he was like, look, he's beating up your husband. Like, open up the door. I'll keep you safe.
Yeah, and actually, at the one part, the criminals used the cameras as a tool to trick her when they thought that she was dragging. Yeah, when they used it to communicate.
Which there is another plot hole with the communication, because there is one point where Jodie Foster is outside of the panic room, and she can hear what they are saying, but then they can also hear what she is saying for, like, one interaction.
Is that when his hand is stuck in the door?
I think it's somewhere around that point.
I thought that's what she was using the intercom to, like, talk to them or something.
No, but, okay, so it's a PA system, so from the panic room, they could talk, but they cannot hear her back, even though they are having a conversation.
I thought there was like a way that she could use the PA system on the outside, and that's what she was doing.
I don't think there was, because that was the whole point of having Jared Leto's character like hold up the signs with like with the words.
Well,
on
maybe
it.
She just didn't. What scene were you talking about? Or if you're talking about the scene where she like has her back against the door?
No, she's talking about the one where she's like, "Please give her the shot," right?
Yeah.
And they're talking to the intercom. I thought.
Yeah.
But isn't the door is like basically closed over his hand.
Sure.
Like so there shouldn't be any way that sound could be able to get through there.
I mean, I really think I thought she could speak into the panic room because I thought she
was just talking into the intercom.
There's a panel.
I'm pretty sure she's just talking into the intercom.
So when the guys are downstairs, they can't speak to Jodie Foster in the panic room. But when Jodie Foster is in the bedroom, she has a panel where she can speak to them in the panic.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
She that's where she was how talking to do it, into. They don't.
Yeah. But then why is there that shot later where Jodie Foster runs up to the one camera and just mouths "fuck you" at them instead of just going up to the intercom and saying "fuck you"?
Because she just wanted to be cool.
Okay.
Because she doesn't want to go to.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Tiny potholes. They aren't the biggest deal.
Because she would have to run all the way up to the room and then say it in the intercom.
Can you imagine?
Why not just use the camera?
1 second.
Brendan is miming the fact that we're on a Zoom call right now, and it would be kind of similar.
This is an audio medium. As we said,
this is an audio medium.
They cannot see
what you just did, Brendan. So no. I had to narrate it for you.
I wanted them to hear me run outside, and it would sound like it was coming from far away.
Brendan, I'm interested in what your plot holes were with this. What were your issues with the script?
Sure. I think a lot of the things that I had problems with were just the actions that were taken by a lot of characters. You know, there were times where I was like, it would make more sense for you to, like, do this, or, like, you know, especially with some of the, like, the ways that the criminals were acting, I was like, wouldn't it have been easier to just comply? Like, why are you still doing this? Like, your daughter is going to die. We've kind of passed over the moments, and I don't really know if I can, like, go back and pinpoint, like, oh, in this scene, it was, like, specifically this that pissed me off, but, like, just, Matt, you were saying earlier how you were like, oh, yeah, this is exactly what I think that they should have done. For me, it was the opposite. I was like, why are they not doing something else? Like, why are they, why did they choose to act this way specifically? You know, I would rather talk about, like, some of the, like, the more interesting things rather than just me harping on, like, well, why didn't she blink to the officer? And why didn't she, like, you know, just go on the other side of the bed instead of reaching and, like, slapping her hand against it to get her phone? Like, you know, it was just a lot of little things that kind of, like, built into this. And then I obviously had problems with, like, Raoul and the cameras and things like that, but... Mm. Other than that, you know.
Yeah. I will say the sequence with the police is where it kind of started to lose me a little bit. I was like, that's where I like wasn't exactly on her side. I didn't really know what she was doing at that point. Like, why don't you just say, like, she knows that the robbers can't hear her.
Can't hear her.
Well, the robbers still have her kid.
Yeah, I know.
And Raoul is crazy.
Right. And they said that if any cops enter the house, then they'll kill the daughter. But like, she could have just said, there are robbers in my house. They're going to kill my daughter if any cops come in the house. So, like, don't
find another way to help.
Make a perimeter and don't do anything until I say it's safe. Yeah, right. I guess. Yeah.
So, I guess that makes sense, but, like, that was probably
I mean, that's what they do.
Yeah. That was, like, probably my favorite scene in the movie. I was, like, on the edge of my seat.
It was very tense.
Like, yes, for that, like, entire 2-minute conversation or whatever. Like, the actor who played the policeman was very good. Mm-hmm. And I loved how he just, you know, kept on persisting because he was like, wait, there's something else here. And I love how you can just read it in Jodie Foster's face, like the tension of should I say it, should I blink, and you see her go like back and forth. And I love her so much. I gotta watch more of her movies, because I just, Silence of the Lambs and this movie, oh my god, she's so good. And this is one of those movies
she
where
doing
like
these days
by the end of it that like I'm screaming at the screen, at the television screen, not because I hate the movie or that there's plot holes, but because like I want them to succeed.
Yeah.
Like when she's fighting Raul at the end with a sledgehammer, I was like, yeah, like fuck him up, like go.
That sledgehammer hit is so unbelievably cathartic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also had a small problem with a sledgehammer hit. She just comes up behind him with this sledgehammer, yeets him in the face. Just
in the
like
face.
Full on smacks him in the face with a sledgehammer. He falls a story.
And then
just
fine?
He's
like, his face would have, like, the bones in his face would have collapsed from that.
Oh, he would be done.
he would be dead.
Done.
This was one of the only moments where I was like, Jodie Foster should do something different. And it was when he was lying at the bottom of the stairs. If I were writing the movie, she would just drop the sledgehammer right on his
face. Just drop the sledgehammer right on him. Just be done with it. Yeah.
Or
no, and the fact that his face wasn't broken, and the fact that he could move after, like, having his hand broken, falling a story, which he just magically landed on his back and went, air got blown out of my lungs and then was fine, to the point where he could beat up Jodie Foster, to the point, you know, it's, again, this is a slick Hollywood thriller.
Sure.
There is going to be these stupid moments that are going to happen.
Yeah.
But it's a movie, you know, these small moments, they'll take you out when they happen, but it's there to entertain you.
People, depending on how big a part people have in movies, they can either be like, knocked out immediately with one punch, or they can survive, you know, a sledgehammer to the face and falling down a flight of stairs. You
somehow.
Know, that's just movies.
It wasn't, see, he didn't fall down a flight of stairs.
He fell a story.
Yes, that's right.
You're right. It wasn't each stair was there to break each individual fall. He just, boom.
He fell the height of a flight of stairs.
Yeah.
Shattered every bone in his body.
That's fair.
But, I mean, unless there's anything else during the actual movie that you guys want to talk about, I think we're good to get to the ending.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is kind of plays into the ending. I was really upset that, you know, they still arrested Burnham, because I feel like he did a good thing. Well, he killed Raoul, who was trying to kill them.
He killed a man.
He did, like, one good thing after, like,
he was still being good for the rest of the movie. Like,
and his one good thing was, like, he did kill a man, so, like, yeah.
I don't know.
I guess
technically, in his case, it wasn't self-defense.
Yeah.
He also stole the $22 million, which I guess, you know, burglary.
Well, it wasn't their $22 million.
Assault at some point, I'm sure they could get him for.
He just stole a person's $22 million. No,
yeah,
I love
it. Wasn't a character we know.
I love when he's holding on.
I mean, technically it was Jodie Foster's at that point. I mean, it was in her safe.
Yeah, I love when he's holding onto the papers, and then they say, open your hands, and he just has to let it all go. I'm like, you piece of shit, open your hands. That is also
that's a great moment, though. Like, he's just like, this is what I was working for the whole time, and eventually he just, like, I think it's obvious, but it's a good moment when he has to let it go, literally, to...
Yeah, into a whirlwind in the backyard of a New York apartment.
Why not? Who cares? It's fun.
They have helicopters above. That's why I thought.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
It rained for like a week straight in 7.
That's true.
Exactly. With the sun out for half the time.
Yep.
The money thing, like him stealing the money, I didn't care about. Because it was some money for some rich guy from New York. Like, it's fine. He can lose it. He's dead anyways. But it was a bit of a strange ending. Like... I don't know. I wonder if there was going to be more with Forest Whitaker's character, if he was going to get away. And then, like, I liked this ending. I didn't like the next scene with the Central Park. But when the music builds and builds and builds and builds, and then it's like this slow, just like dissolve on Jodie Foster's face. I was like, oh, I just like it was going interesting. I didn't think
before
it would end
that though,
way, but I did really like it.
Before that though, I like this sequence with Raoul, like, attacking Jodie Foster and then Forest Whitaker coming up behind, you know, walking away and then coming up behind with a gun. I knew it was going to happen. Like, as soon as Raoul got up from the floor and wasn't dead from the sledgehammer in the fall, I'm like, okay, Forest Whitaker is going to come back and he's going to kill Raoul.
What, because it was written by the Jurassic Park guy and Forest Whitaker is the T-Rex?
I mean, sure. Even though Michael Crichton, I don't know how much the adaptation process was there. Sure. I've never read Jurassic Park, but I don't know. but like I knew Forrest. I mean, it's so obvious Forrest Whitaker's gonna come back. Sure. But then, you know, I do think it's very well directed. It's very well shot.
That was cool.
Yeah, I think that everything while all that's going on is very good. But I don't know how I feel about these last couple of shots, because it feels super eerie in a weird way that I don't think like plays, especially with the next like sequence. Like I don't know what Fincher was going for with the weird music and the close up on Jodie Foster's face. And she's like, is she like regretting like what she did? Because like I feel like she did what she had to do. I don't think she should feel bad about anything that she did.
Yeah, I think I would have sat with me better if they didn't have that terrible tacked on scene of them looking at more apartments and there are all these beautiful. I get it.
Like, do we really need that much space? Like, no.
Okay, like that was dumb. I really hated that. But yeah, I do agree with you, Floyd. It was strange. Like, I didn't hate it, but I was just like,
I didn't hate it either. It threw me off a little bit.
It did, and this does lead me to my next question to Logan, because I can't believe we haven't talked about this yet. I have to hear what Logan's opinion of the Howard Shore score in this movie is. Logan,
the Shore score,
David Fincher, I believe, in this week's movie had his first good score. He used it well. He used a lot of sounds really well. The soda fizzing being one of them that I absolutely loved. I just, such a nice touch to put in there. I really appreciate the sound design. And I think, there's some, I could dive a little bit deeper into this score, as I hadn't really listened to it at all before, but yeah, it definitely wasn't, it wasn't too much of the same. It wasn't just the same thing over and over, like in the game, which makes the movie feel really boring. And it wasn't, you know, every piece of music is something entirely different, and so it doesn't feel like one cohesive unit, like, you know, Fight Club, for me. And yeah, I just felt like, they use a same piece of music by Howard Shore, you know, right at the beginning when we're basically getting introduced to the house. We hear it again, somewhere towards the middle when it's sort of a moment of despair, and you know, we hear it again at the end. I think it's a really, really some really wonderful uses of. Themes that they keep going throughout the whole movie. Yeah, I think Howard Shore knocks it out of the park, and I think Fincher knocks it out of the park in terms of incorporating it into the movie. Yes, I am fully in favor of this score, and it's, for some reason, it's not on Spotify. I'll look for it on YouTube. I like it. Fully in favor of this one.
Nice. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. I mean, for me, nothing will top, and I'm being serious here, the Alien 3 score, which I think is amazing. But I think it's a good score.
Yeah, I don't even remember the Alien 3 score.
Me neither.
Like to forget that movie.
I the only part of that score that I remember is the rock music and the rape scene, but
oh yeah.
When the dude puts on his goggles.
I forgot about that scene. Thank you. Thank you, Logan, for reminding me.
The goggle rape.
Holt McKinley.
Yeah.
McCallany.
McCallany. Yeah. That last scene is weird. I don't even remember noticing the score of this movie, so I don't really have anything to add there, but I trust Logan that it was good.
I liked the dolly zoom in the last shot. It was nice that I was able to recognize that because we've talked about it on this show,
which again feels a little like, why were they dolly zooming there? Like just to give the camera some movement during that scene. Cause it was a strange scene.
Yeah. That seemed dumb.
I wouldn't go as far to say it was dumb. I didn't dislike the dialogue. I didn't dislike the performances. Just didn't feel needed.
I took it to mean she's looking at all the apartment buildings with the houses with a bunch of different rooms, like 3-4 bedrooms, and Jodie Foster says, do you really need all that space? I took that to mean maybe there was a glimmer of hope that she was going to get back together with the dad, but then this scene was saying no, that's not going to happen. That's kind of a dumb thing to happen. So I felt like that's the purpose that this scene had for me, but also it's just kind of to unwind from what just happened.
Just to wind you down.
Very tense scene, right? There needs to be some falling action. We talked a little bit about with some of Hitchcock's movies, how the climax comes right before the end. It's minute before the end of the movie.
That's all older movies.
Yeah, right. It's just all older movies. And I think this is, I think it's a nice way to just sort of bring us out of it, ease us out of it a little bit. And I think it's fine. It's also it's been in this dark house the whole time. And so, sort of a breath of fresh air, literally, to see Central Park, in daylight. I don't mind it.
Yeah, I don't mind it either.
Logan, you brought up the dad. I thought it was funny how this dad,
Did he die?
It really kind of sucks, this whole movie. He doesn't get, like, any sort of redemption. Like, he can't even...
Oh, he could not hit that
guy. He couldn't even shoot Raul at all. He's just, like, sitting there helpless in the chair. Literally, Jodie Foster, like, gives him everything. Like, gives him the gum, gives him the light bulb. He doesn't even want to do it. He wants to call the police. It's funny.
It would have been so easy for a lesser movie to just have the ex-husband come in, and he's this white knight, and he just comes in and wipes out the robbers, and he's armed. He's an American man, and he's got his guns, and... you know, whatever, and he comes in and saves the day, but totally doesn't happen. He's kind of useless in the end, to be honest.
Yes.
And then, you know, in that lesser movie, he would just get back together with Jodie Foster at the end, and it would be a happy family ending. But, like, yeah, it's just, like, not what would happen. And he was...
And Nicole Kidman would somehow show up, yeah.
Right. But, yeah, so I quite liked his role in this, or, you know, his almost lack of much significance in the plot. I thought it was very... Very good. Very good way to subvert expectations.
Nicole Kidman was originally cast as Meg, the role that Jodie Foster was supposed to play.
That makes sense. I was wondering why she was the voice.
Because she left due to a knee injury, which is kind of interesting. And then they replaced her with Jodie Foster. But apparently, like, the role was going to be completely different. And she was going to be, like, a much more, like, childish character. And that Kristen Stewart was going to have to kind of be, like, a child being a parent. To their parent.
I mean, I think that's on type with Kidman and the performances and the types of characters that she did in the 90s. I think I wouldn't have liked that as much.
Probably not.
I liked having Jodie Foster being a strong character.
Yeah. And speaking of Alien again, I definitely got some Ripley vibes from her. She was just such a badass the whole time. Yeah.
The groundwork that Sigourney Weaver laid.
Yep. Yes.
I don't think Nicole Kidman ever came back into a Fincher movie that I can think of, unless she's in Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which, again, I could...
Not to my knowledge. Maybe she's in that. Yeah.
Who's the second lead in that? It's Brad Pitt, and who's...
Viola Davis is in it, and Cate Blanchett.
It's Cate Blanchett, yeah. Yeah, I don't think... that's not... You know, hopefully they work together at some point. I think we kind of hit the end of this discussion, guys. Final thoughts and ratings on David Fincher's Panic Room.
You know, as I said before, I really liked... some parts of this movie, but I also disliked a lot of things. You know, there were a lot of plot holes in it, and you know, there was just like things and times that I didn't feel that the characters were behaving in a way that made sense for the story or that moved it along well. But at the same time, I think that the performances were also really great. And I think that there was a lot of interesting cinematography and things like that. You know, I also recognize that in thrillers, if the characters acted completely logically, the movie would be over in 15 minutes. There wouldn't be a movie if the characters did smart things the whole time. And as frustrating as that may be to watch, I understand that that can, in a lot of horror movies and a lot of things to build suspense, that can kind of be the point. I'm going to give this movie... a B-, just because it still had problems for me, and I was very frustrated watching it, but I think it does have a lot more redeeming qualities that definitely saved it from a rotten rating. So, B-, yeah, that feels right.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed this movie. Like Floyd, I was a little hesitant going in. It's not one of the most talked about Fincher movies. So I wasn't exactly sure what to expect, but I thought it was super fun, super enthralling. Found myself, really gripped from start to finish. I think, Floyd, you hit the nail on the head when you said that this isn't, like, a super significant film for me. It's not, like, a big film in my life, and that's not really a bad thing. I think that this movie did what it had to do, which is kept me engaged for its 2.5-hour runtime. And, you know, the more I talk about it...
It was under 2 hours, just let you know.
Okay, and the more I talk about it... 2.5 hours. The more I talk about it, the more I like it. I think it's really enjoyable. You know, it's probably not going to be up there in terms of, my Fincher movies ranked, but it's definitely a really great movie. I'm going to give it a B+.
I really enjoyed this movie while I was watching it. And I think still, you know, upon discussing it a little bit more, I think it still really holds up. There are great performances all around. I don't think that they're very many really egregious plot holes. You know, when people act irrationally, I think it's because of their situation and maybe they're not exactly thinking clearly, and you know, can't always fault them for that. If I have an issue with it. It's that the premise just inherently doesn't allow for, you know, a ton of exciting stuff. It's basically, you know, it all happens in one house, and that's fine. But I think within the bounds that the premise inherently sets, I think they do an incredible job. You know, like I said, it's just this amazing cat and mouse chess game. I think it's a severely underrated film, and I think I'm definitely gonna come back to this one. I'm gonna go A- for this one.
Yeah, this is a solid film for me. Like I said earlier, like Matt said, you know, it's not a hugely significant film, but I think it is a big deal for me in terms of Fincher. It's his last movie that's like this, that feels like it's a Hollywood studio thriller, and I think he proved to me just like, yeah, he can nail these kind of movies, you know. This isn't anything spectacular, but there's nothing in this that I would say is, like, bad, maybe, other than some of the Raoul character, which, again, I don't even think it's that big of a deal. And it, you know, I'm gonna give this movie a B, but I don't think that's because, like, you know, the points I'm taking off is just mainly just because, like, yeah, it's just a rote Hollywood thriller, you know, it's an entertaining rote Hollywood thriller. It's not like I'm saying, like, oh, all these things were bad, so I'm knocking it down from an A+ to a B. No, it's just, like, that's all the movie was going for, and I was entertained for, I think an hour and 45 minutes it was the right length, pacing was very good, it felt breezy, it didn't feel like, you know, it was slogging along, and all the performances were really good. Jodie Foster was great. Kristen Stewart was great. Forest Whitaker was a standout for me. I thought he was fantastic. Yeah, I mean, very well directed by Fincher. A very solid script, I think, by Kep. So yeah, overall, this movie's a B. This is a solid film, but not one I'm going to ever come back to, probably. But that's not a bad thing, you know? Not every movie needs to be this, you know, huge thing that you keep coming back to, you know? It's fine. And when you make as many movies as Fincher does, you know, I think he's about to make his 11th film with Mank, or he made his 11th film with Mank. You know, not every single one's going to be this huge tentpole thing in your career. Sometimes you made a movie. Good. It's a good, solid thriller. So yeah, I like this movie a lot, and yeah, I don't think it'll be near the top of my ranking. It's definitely not at the bottom. I mean, it's definitely no Alien 3. But yeah, so next week we got Zodiac coming up, a big film for Matt. I think a big film for me. I haven't seen it in a while, but I remember loving it. So big film in terms of scope and in terms of actors and in terms of historical, you know, significance.
This film is a masterpiece, one of my favorite movies of all time. I'm really excited. You know, I know Logan, I guess with the exception of this film, has been fairly lukewarm on most of these Fincher movies, but I really think that this one is going to hit on all cylinders for both of you. It's fantastic, and the cast for this movie is stellar. Mark Ruffalo, Robert Downey Jr., Jake Gyllenhaal, a whole bunch of Jake others.
Gyllenhaal. The actual Zodiac killer, Ted Cruz, makes an appearance.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yes, yeah, he did.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm super excited to do that next week. I'm super excited just to watch this movie again, because it's a movie that I've been meaning to watch again for a while. So yeah, come back next week for Zodiac, and then after, sometime either between this episode and after next episode, we'll be doing a mini-sode announcing our next round of picks, because as we'd said before, Zodiac's going to be the, or I guess right after this, yeah, why not? Zodiac's going to be the last on our first part of our David Fincher series. We didn't want to just be doing David Fincher for 10 weeks or 11 weeks. We wanted to break it up a little bit. Also, this will help line up with Mank, which is supposed to come out in October, which they actually haven't announced a release date yet, but producer said it's coming out in October. So Netflix doesn't really announce their release dates normally until a month or two ahead of time anyway. I think we just found out that I'm Thinking of Ending Things comes out on September 4th, like literally 2 weeks ago, and it's coming out in 2 weeks. So, But it'll line up nice. It'll give us a little break. We're going to be talking about either overrated or underrated movies. So come back to the feed very shortly to find out what those movies are going to be, because I haven't decided what my movie's going to be yet. But Logan, do you want to tell the good people about the other shows on our network?
Absolutely. You know, if you like the Cinema Talk podcast, which you just listened to a lot of, you might also enjoy the CTP Movie Journal, which is Matt and Ryan's miscellaneous short-form movie podcast featuring the best of list. You can also check out Stop, Wait, What, our improv comedy advice show, Back in Style, our newcomer-friendly episodic review of Twin Peaks, Twisted Mug Mysteries, your one-stop shop for everything spooky and occult, Octo Island, our extended universe Star Wars podcast, and I Might Play That, our all-new video game review podcast.
Yes, yeah. And as always, we are on social media. We are at Twisted Mug Media on Instagram and Twitter. Please go hit us up there. Give us a follow. We'd be so thankful to receive your support. And if you'd like to contact us, You can do so through those platforms or through our email, which is twistedmugmedia@gmail.com. Yeah, this has been a great episode. Definitely go check us out on those platforms, please. And thank you, 5-star rating on iTunes, please.
We also have a YouTube channel, which is something brand new that we've kind of been working on. It is the Twisted Mug Media Network on YouTube. We have a couple videos up there right now. I did a video on Spice. Ryan has done 2 Criterion hauls. We'll be having more video essays.
Which I forgot to post the second one. I'm going to do that as soon as we hang up this call.
Whoops. So second Criterion haul will have just come out by the time you're listening to this. So go check that out. Very cool stuff. I'm going to be doing a video on the Muppets in the future. If you follow my Letterboxd account, you'll have followed my journey down the Muppet hole. So go check that out. It's gonna be a good time. We're gonna be posting some comedy stuff on there eventually, and other things. But make sure to subscribe, like, comment, retweet, reblog, tickle my balls, what have you. But go check it out on YouTube. Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, and just one small thing. I just ordered a whole bunch of Blu-rays for myself for my birthday. Got some good deals on Best Buy, so I'll probably do a haul video. I think I'm just going to start. I just like doing Blu-ray video, my Blu-ray collection video, so I think I'm just going to be keep your eyes peeled. I got the first part of the haul came to me yesterday, and I have more coming. So keep your eyes on the YouTube channel to see what Blu-rays I'm adding to my collection. So come back next week for our review of Zodiac, and also throughout the week of all of our rest of our shows, plus our picks for the next round. So thanks for listening, guys. I'm Ryan.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Matthew.
And I'm Logan.
And we'll talk to you next week. See you guys. Fuck was that?